Maximum Bob is on the set.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 205 for August 2nd of 2013. Bob Lutz's Icons and Idiots. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Peter D.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing really good. Good to be here with you again.
Good to be here.
I've been missing in action for a while here, too.
I know. We held down the phone for you.
I know you did. And we got Chubba Chetta with us, formerly of Car and Driver, and still very active in this business.
It comes and goes, but it's still fun, and I kind of think I know something about it, so I may as well make some money that way.
That's great. And, of course, the real reason we're so excited tonight is we got Bob Lutzen here with us. Bob, great having you here.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
We'll be talking about a whole bunch of things tonight, but I'm just curious. I mean, you've been at Ford, BMW, Chrysler, General Motors. You've seen
twice. Yeah.
You've seen so much of where this industry has gone and where it's going. And that's what I want to ask. What's your outlook for the industry right now?
I think for the next 15 or 20 years, it's going to be good. We'll probably, have another recession or so. But fundamentally, as I look at the next 2 or 3 years, I see onward and upward. And especially for the U.S. producers, frankly, I think after 20 years of maybe 30 years of trying to get by on mediocrity, I think all three American companies have discovered that only excellence, only product excellence, that's the only formula that'll work in today's marketplace. And I really believe that all three U.S. companies are now producing products that are so good that they'll regain market share, and they represent a fantastic value compared to imports. And then, of course, the American brand, especially General Motors, is doing exceptionally well in China. And we tend to be U.S.-centric. You know, we tend to think, how's everybody doing in the U.S.? That still matters a lot, but it's no longer what matters most. What matters most now is how are you doing in China? And on that score, American producers are doing, by and large, better than the Japanese. So I just see continued growth, a genuine comeback for the Detroit automakers, but growth for everybody.
I noticed in China, BMW was just denied some sort of agreement from the government or permit to do something there. Do you think that's going to be more of a problem as we go forward in China?
It's a problem anywhere where you have a central government that essentially regulates the industry. And you can really only do business with a Chinese partner. If you want to be a component supplier, you're allowed to put in a plant and own it 100%. But if you're an OEM, you need a Chinese partner. I'm not familiar with this BMW issue, but
yeah.
I think we're all familiar enough with government bureaucracies and government regulation that we know that that can be a big problem. And in a country like China, where the government is all powerful, it can obviously be an even bigger problem.
You know, there's no question the product coming out of the big three is really good. But I hear things every now and then that disturb me. I mean, I still see a lot of cheap leases and incentives. And, you know, they're possible today because interest rates are pretty low. But it does seem that the industry has kind of fallen back a little bit to buying sales.
But wait a minute, Chubba. Incentives are now lower than at the same time last year. all three of the domestics, I mean, Chrysler the most because they were so heavy into daily rental that they, daily rental and cheap fleet that they had almost no retail. But part of the hidden success, renewed success of Chrysler is that they've been able to dial back a lot on daily rental, as has General Motors. I'm not quite sure where Ford is, but I imagine it's the same thing. And the real story is that the U.S. industry is now relying much, much less on what poor business that used to drive numbers, but destroyed residuals, didn't retain owners, et cetera, and was purely a price-based business. You look at Ford and GM now, or Jeep. I mean, the average transaction prices are probably, even inflation-adjusted, at least 10% over where they were prior to 08. And I know GM is watching leases very carefully. And you look at the July results, the real story is, yeah, the overall sales gain for GM was like 12%, but retails were up like 30%. So, which means that I'm not sure of that number. I may remember. I was going to bring all these sheets with me tonight, and I forgot them. But it's all three domestic companies are expanding their retail base and relying less on poor business, and incentives are down. And remember back in the old days when people used – old days about 10 years ago when people said – you know Japanese cars are better because look at Detroit. They have to offer incentives and the Japanese don't. Well, almost the incentive king now is the Toyota Camry as they're desperately trying to hang on to the number one spot. And we all remember when the Ford Taurus tried to do that. I mean, trying to hang on to the number one spot by heavy discounting gets you absolutely nothing except poor residuals.
Well, are you disturbed by, I mean, it's an announcement like GM saying they're going to keep the Cruise in production for an extra year because it seems to be selling well. And on one hand, you look at that and it makes sense. On the other hand, if you want to be the best in that class, the earlier you introduce the next model that's even better, you cement your reputation.
I know the background of that, Chubba.
Okay.
And
the Cruise, and I say that admiring the Cruise and thinking it's a pretty good car now.
They can change the grill and do a new grill like the revision on the I'm not sure they're going to do that, but if they had to, they could do a new front end, like the new Impala front end, and like the Malibu being freshened with that same front end, which is the new Chevy identity. That personally, if I were there, that's what I'd do, because you can easily get another 2 years out of that car. I think the story of the Cruise was the replacement, which I had seen at some was causing some people some worry. And it rather than go with a program that you really are not sure of, it's just better to stop. The current one's fine. We can easily sell that one for another couple of years, and let's do a melt and repour on the new one.
Hmm. One of the things why the domestics are doing a whole lot better is, I mean, you had enormous influence at GM before the big collapse, before the bankruptcies and all that. Everybody was just trying to cheapen the product. And one of the things that you've been preaching is, no, spend a little bit more money, make the car better.
Yeah, and, you know, that was the whole thesis of my book, Car Guys versus Bean Counters, in this try to shave cost to get the numerical margins up on paper on a future product program is self-defeating, and it's a race toward the bottom, and the transaction prices that you write down when you're doing the plan for that car, if you cheapen it enough, you're never going to get those transaction prices in the real world. And it took the finance guys forever to figure out that all of these programs look great on paper, and then when the car was on the market a few years, it was a financial disaster, and they could never connect the dots. But one of the things, and I sort of have to correct an old view of mine. I always thought it would be a disaster if CEOs came into this industry with no automotive background. I'm revising my opinion on that, because what we had was a sort of as standardized, all three companies, as standardized Harvard MBA executive who then spent 30 years in the business learning exactly how you manage product programs, and it's all totally financially driven. It's squash the investment down, squash the piece cost down, make the base model with tires so skinny that nobody will buy it, and then option up to the right tire size, you know. And all of that sort of assuming that the customer is not very smart, but we owe it to the shareholders to make this program look good on paper. I think if in all three companies, if the successors had been 30-year veterans of the automobile industry, there would have been a very strong tendency to slip back into the bad old ways of doing business. What you've got now is three CEOs who have no prior experience in the automobile business, and they came to it with a fresh set of eyes. And I know in Dan Ackerson's case, he looked at it and he said, well, bad cars didn't do well. Great cars seem to do well. Ergo, let's keep doing great cars with high value. And, you know, the Impala was kind of on its way when I left. The design was finished. The architecture was finished, but the execution of the car had just begun. And I, needless to say, had some worries because I thought with my pressure for excellence in NVH, brakes, interior materials, and everything, I was afraid that the old bean counterism would make a comeback. The Empire Strikes Back, you know, and the car would become a sort of an average American large car again. Didn't happen. I mean, I can't imagine that car could have turned out any better than it did. So I think in all three companies, the ethic, and then look at the Grand Cherokee. I mean, I really, in that category of sport utility, that thing is just fantastic. Whether it's engine, transmission, driveline, off-road capability, and interior. So I think, I got a chance to say this on, I think, Power Lunch on CNBC the other day. They said, what's happening? What's all this happening with the American automobile industry? And I said, the American automobile industry is on a genuine roll. And I think people who are not considering American cars for their next purchase are depriving themselves of a great deal of value.
You got to be thrilled then. Consumer Reports picked the Impala as their best pick, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they said the best of all, and it's got to be, they say 30 years since Consumer Reports picked an American car. In my lifetime, I don't remember it.
I don't remember, or right. I can't imagine what that one was 30
me neither.
Years ago, could you?
It was ancient.
That obviously was a validation, and as I look at the sales figures, the Impala is moving out really well, and again, at transaction prices, thousands of dollars over the old Impala. Thousands of dollars. Now, let's assume that compared to the old Impala, there is, and this was sort of the recipe that I was constantly dangling in front of the finance people. I said, let me put 500 more into the car and we'll recover at least 2,000 more on average transaction prices. That has worked out even better. I mean, transaction, and in some cases it's less than $500. In other cases, it's way more than $500. But the way the transaction prices have moved, because people are willing to pay for excellence. It's that simple. If people fall in love with it, look at the Ford Fusion, you know, a genuinely nice car. I think one of the best design jobs ever in the midsize sedan segment. And I haven't driven it, but I understand it's...
No, it's a good car.
Drives as good as it looks.
Yeah, it's a very competent car. I'm sure it goes down the road very well. It's going to be reliable, good fuel economy. And nobody ever thought that an American brand could challenge the Japanese in the midsize segment. But now the Fusion is constrained only by capacity. Only by capacity.
Well, when you look at incentives, and you know, you're pointing out how the Japanese imports are running a lot of incentives, at least some of them are.
I'm amazed at what's happening at the top of the segment, where you've got your former company, BMW, sort of in a death struggle for Mercedes for number one in the luxury area.
Yeah.
And these guys are supposed to be exclusive brands.
Well, that's what I always say.
And they're going nuts.
Well, this is like what happened 30 years ago between Cadillac and Lincoln. Try to be the number one luxury brand, and they were doing all, I still remember ads in the Detroit Free Press. Now, at Hertz, rent a Lincoln Town Car for as little as $19.95 a day, you know. And I showed it to Don Peterson. I said, Don, we're trying to build Lincoln as a prestige brand. How is this compatible with what we're trying to do? Don't worry about it, Bob. We've got plants to fill, and we have... To me, trying to be world's most popular prestige brand is a lot like trying to be world's tallest midget.
It just
doesn't work.
Yeah.
Or it's a title that's meaningless. And I think both with a lot of the heavily discounted leases that both BMW and Mercedes are using, at some point when the cars become ubiquitous, the prestige value fades.
Well, it may start happening that the cars become very common, and at some point, interest rates are going to pick up from where they are today. I mean, these are historic low levels. When interest rates pick up, lease rates are going to pick up. I mean, right now, the lease rates are low, both because they're subventing them a little bit, but also because the cost of money is pretty low, and one of those things is going to go away at some point.
But, BMW has been exceptionally good at maintaining residuals despite the heavy leasing, and that's because they've done an exceptionally good job at remarketing the off-lease cars. They've done that better than anybody else.
I have two CPO BMWs in my garage. I mean, I've been sold on it. You know, it's a good way to get into that brand and get cars that are in very good shape for a considerable discount.
Well, I told myself I'd never buy another new car. I'd buy everything 2 year off lease with 24,000 miles. And I finally broke down. I drove by the Suburban Chevrolet's lot and saw a Camaro convertible in metallic orange with white stripes. And I just there's something about it that drew me over to it. And it was exactly the spec I wanted. So that was the first new car I've bought in a long time. But other than that, I like 2 year old off lease with, say, 25,000 miles, and manufacturer's powertrain warranty still in place. You can't go wrong.
Well, and a lot of the CPO programs like BMW's, you know, they've got a 4 year, 50,000 mile new car warranty. And with CPO, they add 2 years and 50,000 miles to it.
Yeah.
So, in fact, when I bought my 335, it was slightly less than 2 years old. So I had slightly longer in time warranty than a brand new car did. And I had my car, I think, had 22,000 miles on it. So I had a 78,000 mile warranty as opposed to a 50,000 mile one. It's pretty hard to argue with that.
Barely broken in.
Yeah.
Modern cars at 24,000 miles are like brand new.
Hey, you just mentioned Don Peterson. You've, of course, come out with your book, Icons and Idiots, where you talk about all kinds of people that you either work for or mentored you in your career. One of my favorite stories in the book, and it's a terrific book, by the way.
Thank you.
Is you talked about the Fiesta development program in Europe, working with Red Poling.
Yeah.
And the team came in and said, Red, we got to do this car, and it's going to cost $1.1 billion. And he said, okay, you can have $400 million. Go do it. And kept beating them down.
Yeah, well, that was when in the part with, I mean, Red Poling was... may he rest in peace, but was an extremely difficult guy to work for and not always totally rational in his financially oriented decision making. I mean, he was often the guy who would be penny wise and pound foolish. But some of the lessons on toughness, which I had a tendency to believe the teams, you know, naively. I was only a marketing guy. If they came and said, we've looked at this program, it's going to be, this was the second generation Fiesta. If they told me it was $1 billion, I would sort of say, well, are you sure? And they said, of course we're sure, we're presenting it. And, oh, okay, well, in that case, you know. And what we did with the Fiesta, at Poling's insistence, second gen, because we didn't make any money on the first gen, Poling said, look, on the, with the volume we've got, and with if you figure the variable cost of the car plus the fixed cost, but part of the fixed cost allocation, of course, is depreciation and amortization, he said, we can't afford to spend more than $400 million on this program. And I said, okay, tough challenge. I mean, it'll be a lot of carryover and so forth. And the engineering guys came, or the product guys came in with $1.1 billion. And I said, no, that's not going to work. You have to come back with $400. $400? That's not a new car. I said, well, you know, use your creativity, but that's what it is. And they came back in 2 weeks or 3 weeks and said, we've really gutted the program. We've had to give up a lot of stuff and so forth, and it's 800. And I said, what is there about 400 that you don't understand? I mean, I was being as tough as Poling, and everybody grumbled and said, he's getting to be just like the chairman. But, you know, you're not running a popularity contest. You can't please people in situations like that. So they went away, and ultimately they came back at 400, or it was maybe 470 or something. And I said, it's not 400. And they said, well, the only way we can get to 400 is to not redo the front suspension. And the front suspension is the weak point of the car. It doesn't have enough travel. It's the number one customer complaint and so forth and so on. And we need a new engine box to accommodate a new strut setup and with longer travel and so forth. So I went to Red and I said, look, they're at 470, but they need a new front suspension. And I agree, it's a good deal. And Red said, well, I don't remember reading any magazine articles about the poor front suspension and how many sales have we lost due to poor front suspension and how about everybody else's front suspension? He says, look, as far as I'm, is it a quality problem? No. But people just don't like it. He says, well, that's not a reason. Tell them 400. So I went back and said, no front suspension. And they crestfallen, you know, and they went away. And darn it, in 3 weeks' time, they came back and said, one of our guys devised a way where we can package an interesting new linkage. We don't have to change the engine box or the front end structure of the car. And it's, I think it was $7 or $10 million. And at that point, I said, you got it. And I went to Red and I said, Red, I overran the 400 because we're getting the new front suspension for, I don't know, 7 or 10 or something. And he said, well, okay, but you see what happens when you're tough. And you know, that was repeated at GM with the current Equinox, where the product planners basically wanted the Equinox to have the same chassis as the Cadillac SRX. And I said, well, what does that do to piece cost? Well, that was naturally up because Cadillac is premium and Chevrolet isn't. And I said, what's it do to investment? Well, you know, it's only another $300 million. And I said, well, you can't have it. And then I got the litany of horrible things that would happen. We can't package a larger wheel and tire. We can't increase the tread. We can't do this. We can't do that. You've driven an Equinox. You know it's not a very good vehicle and so forth. And I said, well, do the best you can. And over the course of the program, the Equinox got bigger wheels and tires. It got the added tread. It got the NVH materials. It got the structure, to the point where most of the magazines and most of the media reported that the Equinox had the same architecture as the SRX. So they had, with deprived of the funds, they nonetheless attained the goal of doing a superb, quiet, well-selling automobile. So now I ask myself, Why did we approve the investment on the SRX?
Well, the question I have in that, and I read your book, and mm-hmm. I read that chapter that you just basically summarized there. And, you know, you walked away with it saying that there's merit to being financially tough because when you push people, they get creative.
Yeah.
At the same time, if you're too financially tough, yeah, you get to where GM was for a long time, yeah, and the product wasn't very good. No, because so how do you balance that?
It's yin and yang.
Yeah.
And I think the good automotive executive, the successful automotive executive knows, intuitively knows where the balance lies.
Because you made it sound like with polling, financial discipline was everything.
Yeah.
And he would be happier with a car that came in on budget, even though it was unsaleable and sold as rather than one that came in a little over and sold at a profit.
Famous anecdote, one of the tune-ups he gave me, he said, you know what your problem is? I said, no, what, Red? He says, your problem is if the devil came to you and said, if you overrun the cost objective by $50, I will reward you by making this the best car the world has ever seen and a bestseller. And you'd take the deal. I said, for $50 a car, you bet I would. And he said, well, see, I wouldn't, because the cost objective is sacred. You can't violate it. You've got to hang your hat on something. Well, that's just rigid thinking. And it was like, well, there was one point where everybody in Europe with manuals was going to 5-speed transmissions. And I said to Red, look, we need to invest in a 5-speed transmission for the Fiesta and the Escort, at least. 5-speed sounds almost ridiculous now, but yeah, it
sounds so archaic.
So, I remember that transition. Yeah, hate to say it, you know.
So Red, bless him, commissions a study with the finance guys to see how often fifth gear is actually used. And it turned out to be, you know, what with urban environments and the relative paucity of autobahn driving, et cetera, in most of Europe, fifth gear was probably engaged by the average owner maybe less than 10% of the time. And so there was, during the 10% usage, there was a minute improvement in fuel economy, which didn't offset the added cost and price for the fifth gear. So the net conclusion of the study was fifth gear makes no sense whatsoever, because the cost recovery in terms of gasoline savings do not pay for the extra investment that the customer has to make for the fifth gear. Therefore, we're staying with... I said, Red, that may be, you know, that may be true, that may be factual, but that's not the market perception. The market perception is, with my fifth gear here, I save fuel. He wouldn't approve it. The same thing with the diesel engine for the small cars in Europe. And of course, diesels have been ubiquitous at the low end of the market in Europe for many decades. But this was just the beginning, and Volkswagen was like selling 60% diesel Golfs. And we wanted a diesel, and the same analysis was done that showed that the customer never recovers the added cost of the diesel engine. And again, it doesn't matter. If people think they're saving, if people will willingly pay an increment more for a diesel with the belief that, okay, I paid more for my car, but now look at the money I'm saving. And I remember, against his advice, I was anointed chairman of Ford of Europe after he left, and we were all out at Stansted Airport watching the G4 the G4 take off, and the whole executive team was there, and when the wheels were safely up and the flaps were up and the airplane was getting smaller and smaller in the sky, I turned to the guys and said, prepare the appropriation request for the 5-speed and the diesel.
Hey, wait, hold on. We got to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll come back to that. But, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there, running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
AutoLine offers you one of the most effective ways to get your marketing message in front of the decision makers in the global automotive industry. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Okay, Chubba, I had to cut you off there.
No problem. Well, given what you just said about making decisions with Red polling, and, you know, your book was interesting in the sense that you described your relationship with these guys and told a lot of anecdotes about your dealings, and many of those were non-flattering. But you ended almost every chapter on a positive note. And the name of the book is Icons and Idiots. And I don't think you used the word idiot anywhere in the...
No, I didn't. And there's a reason for that.
Is this mellowing
Icon,
with
Icons
old age?
Icons and Idiots was my working title.
Which is a great title, by the way.
Well, see, that's the point. And that's what the publisher said. I told the publisher, look, it's only a working title. There you go. I mean, you're sounding
people
like
buy it.
You're sounding like the publisher. Yeah. I was going to call it Icons and Their Idiosyncrasies, and the publisher said, forget that. Icons and Idiots is great. Let's leave it. And a lot of people have said to me, well, who's an icon and who's an idiot? And what I try to explain is that's not the breakdown. The breakdown is all of us, to some extent, are a careful blend of icon and idiot, in that we all have our weak sides, our weird habits, maybe some of us the difficulties in... I mean, nobody really knows how good or bad they are at dealing with subordinates, because your subordinates will never tell you that.
That's right.
That you're a bad boss. So you don't know. And I'm sure that, like Phil Caldwell and Red Poling, were blissfully unaware that they weren't absolute stellar leaders. And so I think what I tried to do is show that some of these much admired and highly successful personalities did have some traits that the public never saw, but that we saw internally, especially those who worked very closely with these people, to where you just sometimes wondered, how did these people become so successful? And yet they had, so for instance, in Phil Caldwell's case, you know, he liked to appropriate items from hotels and company stuff, like this special Cussons Imperial Leather Soap that Ford Motor Company had at the Grafton Street townhouse. That was Henry Ford's personal townhouse. A very expensive English soap, beautiful sort of olive green bars with a foil emblem in the center. And he liked those, and he got me aside in one meeting, and everybody thought, well,
That's so amazing. You know, I mean, we've all been in nice hotels where you encounter a nice bar of soap.
Yeah.
It's okay. Maybe you take it home,
yeah,
but you don't send out one of your underlings to get a dozen more for you.
Well,
as a multimillionaire.
He sent me out to get a box.
Yeah, that's pitiful.
Yeah, it is. But and then he was the one at the hotel in Munich where he had the hotel manager gather up a whole airline bag full of those little, at the time they were European little jam pots. It was before they made their way across the Atlantic. And that was all done with the utmost secrecy. But on the good side, I wouldn't call Phil Caldwell a car guy, but he knew the Ford Motor Company needed to do something dramatically different. He knew, he could see the way Americans were accepting the European design ethic. And I'll make no secret of it, the sort of idealized design target for the first Taurus was an Audi 200, or what we would now call the Audi A6 or the Audi A8. And there were a lot of detractors at Ford. And said, that's never going to work. We need to do something like an Oldsmobile 98, you know, a nice vertical backlight with a vinyl roof and some opera windows and so forth. And Phil Caldwell listened to the right people, and he hung in there and did the Taurus and the Sable. The other thing he'd had was an unflinching focus on quality and reliability. I mean, I've seen other CEOs who... occasionally in a meeting, they'd say, well, what's with our quality? You know, we got to do something. We're not looking very good in J.D. Power and so forth. Caldwell was on it. I mean, he never relented on the quality issue. And he said many times, look, we're in financial trouble. We're not sure the company's going to survive. But if we go out of business, I want people to say, what a shame. They were building the best cars in the world. So
Ford never quite got there, I'd say, in that time period. But
they made progress for their day. They brought in Dr. Deming.
Well, but
and a
at
bunch
least
of
they were trying. By far the best domestic for a while.
Hey, your book, though, what I wanted to bring up is this book sounds more like Bob Lutz than any of the other books that you've written. I mean, I could hear your voice talking as I read the thing. Was this more you doing it on your own than the prior ones?
No, I wrote all three of my books uniquely by myself. The only one that had help was my first one, Guts, The Seven Laws of Chrysler and so forth, Seven Laws of Business That Made Chrysler the World's Largest. And there was a chapter in the middle that sort of described the history of Chrysler from the time I got there until I left. And the, you know, the Viper chapter was fine, but then there was sort of a history chapter. And my then editor was a guy that I'm still in touch with by the name of Alan Farnham, who was a writer at the time at Fortune. Alan said, look, I've liked all your chapters, and I've had to change very little, but this one really sucks. I mean, this one is, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And he says, it is so boring, it put me to sleep. I'll take a whack at it. So he wrote it, and it was funny as hell and vibrant and caught your attention. The trouble is it was totally factually inaccurate.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, and I said, Alan, look, yours is... Mine was accurate but dull. Yours is funny and hopelessly inaccurate, and I can't put my name to that. So in desperation, I turned to my then speechwriter, Tim Yost, and said, Tim, I've got a big assignment for you. Take my version and Alan Farnham's version and try to make it as amusing as his and as factual as mine. So that whole chapter was kind of blended by Tim Yost. But then, of the three books, that is really the only chapter that I didn't write. And as I like to say, I write 110% of my books because my editor takes 10% out, as I do tend to run on at times. Or I'll repeat stuff. You know, I don't reread what I've written before. And what sometimes happens is I'll
say it again.
Use the same example again.
One guy I would have liked to have seen you cover in your book is Don Peterson. And I don't know if you didn't work for him directly.
I did, yeah.
But of those three, I mean, I was actually at Ford when Caldwell became chairman. But, of course, I was a lowly peon. And I was a lowly peon when I started at Car and Driver during his administration. Poling was never one to go out with the press. But Peterson I actually spent some time with. Mm-hmm. And of those three, he actually struck me as the guy most interested in product. And, you know, then you hear weird stories about him behind the scenes. And I just would have been curious to get your take on Peterson.
Don Peterson was, in the car guys versus bean counters continuum, you would put him more on the car guy side. He came up through product planning. I would say he was not a natural car enthusiast, but he was very much focused on good product. Peterson's weirdness had more to do with a lack of patience and an extreme temper tantrums, where he could be extremely pleasant up to a point, and then all of a sudden the smile would become more and more frozen, and then at some point he would explode, and you didn't want to be around when that happened. So I think people were a little wary of him at times, but overall, I really had to focus on the people that I had worked with most, and the people who had the most strange habits,
yeah,
or who were the most skewed. I would say Don Peterson was pretty well balanced, and it's hard to write an icons and their idiosyncrasies story about a person who is extremely well balanced. That's why, you know, the chapter on Rick Wagner doesn't really, I can't come up with any strange stuff that he did or strange opinions that he had, or
He seemed like a pretty balanced and normal guy.
But I thought your take was really well explained on him, that he was a great peacetime general.
Yeah, and he was a wonderful, extremely well-balanced, good listener, fair to people, took everybody's opinion into account, was never dictatorial, and was there and gave me absolute backing on the product development side. I mean, it was like a nuclear umbrella. I could pretty much get anything anything I wanted. So that was all wonderful. But the downside of the GM upbringing, with the tremendous GM focus on gentlemanliness and decorum and don't use any. I mean, Chrysler was under Iacocca. It was the F-bombs were flying everywhere.
Yeah, I know, Bob. I was your agency guy. Yeah. I remember presenting to Bob and Lito and Ben Bidwell through the cigar smoke.
Yeah, what a zoo that was.
Trying to convince them to do a campaign.
But with for instance, an example was of not being, I don't want to say tough enough, but not being arbitrary enough. Because usually we think of arbitrariness on the part of the boss as a bad trait. But there is a time when arbitrariness becomes an essential leadership characteristic.
I mean, you got to make a call.
You never move forward.
Yeah.
And honest, when it came time, when I got there, I was stunned because I wanted to bring the Holden Monaro in as a Pontiac with the GTO was the only name we could think of. And because I thought we needed one good rear-wheel drive car. And we didn't want the sedan because it would have cannibalized the Pontiac and Buick sedans. But Pontiac had no big coupe, so it seemed logical. When I first brought it up, the reaction was, well, we don't make that. I said, what do you mean we don't make it? Well, it's not a North American car. I said, well, but it's General Motors. Oh, no. Those guys are like a separate company, and General Motors consolidates the results at the top. But we were running four autonomous car companies, Asia Pacific, Europe, North America, and Latin America. And they all had, I will say the powertrain guys had managed to achieve a degree of integration in that the Ecotec was global and the automatic transmissions were global and the four-valve V6 was a global engine. So the powertrain guys had managed to break through the barriers, but the vehicle guys had their own, no, we know what's best for Europe. We don't want to share any products. And North America was, you guys don't know the North American market. It's different over here. And
but wasn't part of the problem, too, the UAW didn't want foreign-made cars?
No, it wasn't. We weren't going to import them. You just wanted common engineering, which we now have. You know, the Epsilon 2 is a global architect.
No, but I mean bringing the Monaro from Austria.
Oh, that was at the volumes. They weren't they worried about
okay.
that. And we finally got it done. So I advanced the idea of global product development. You know, what BMW makes the same car all over the world. Mercedes does. Volkswagen does. Toyota does. They don't have a North American division that makes unique cars. And it was part of a larger strategy also to be, depending on exchange rates, you could move components around and source them from different places. And Rick Wagner, being supremely intelligent, immediately got it and said, yeah, we ought to move in that direction. No question about it. And for the next 2 years, we'd always bring it up at the ASB meetings. And needless to say, the president of GM Europe and the president of Latin America and the president of Asia Pacific didn't like it and had all kinds of reasons why this would never work. And we can do it ourselves much cheaper, you know, and all the old arguments. And I was always waiting for Rick to say, well, look, we've looked at all this stuff. This is the same story I've heard for the last 20 years. we're going to do global programs. Is that understood? And that never came, you know. And I honestly think we wasted 2 years in getting there. And then Mullally comes into town, and he makes his courtesy visit to Rick Wagner and says, Rick, my guys are telling me that we need different cars for Europe and for the United States. And that doesn't sound right, because Boeing doesn't make different airliners for different countries. And Rick says, well, actually, Alan, we used to believe that too, but we have just transitioned to a global architecture system. And Alan says, thank you very much, Rick. Well, it's been nice saying hi to you, and I hope we'll be friendly competitors. And like within a week, Ford announced that they were going to global architectures, and the head of international operations quit because he didn't like it. But you know, that was collateral damage. But my point is, there is a time when a chief executive has to be so convinced of the correctness of a decision that he is willing to risk a momentary loss of popularity or have guys go away from the meeting angry, but the thing has to be done. And it was almost, I find it very difficult to criticize Rick for this, because it's such a good human trait. And yet, in business, it probably would have been better if I had gone home occasionally and kicked the dog and said, God darn that Wagner. But I think nobody.
I'm sure that's exactly what you would have said.
Well, I know we're on air, but nobody ever went home saying that.
You know, delaying a decision rarely makes it better. Wasn't it Patton who once said that a good plan today is better than a great plan tomorrow? I mean, you know, you got to get off the dime and get rolling on
something. Well, the other one that's true, and it's also an old combat expression, is, the best battle plan in existence doesn't survive more than 2 minutes after you actually engage the enemy. And the same thing is true in our business. And all these future scenarios and how everything's going to work out just aren't worth the powder to blow them to hell. Just may as well have a plan that sounds good and go with it.
Napoleon always said, La bataille répondra, which means we'll set out our battle plans, but then the battle will respond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and you know, maybe you set up some contingency plans, but if you assume you can plan 15 years out, that's pretty risky in this world.
Well, that was Caldwell.
Yeah.
And I guess we had McKinsey Company, I'm pretty sure it was. Then everybody was peddling long-range planning at the time. And they got into Ford and they interviewed, as the consulting companies always do, they interviewed at all levels, and their premise was finance has too much power in Ford. And when they interviewed me, I said, well, I absolutely agree. You know, it's the power's got to go to the operating people and so forth. The upshot of millions of dollars of study spent was that the finance staff had to be disenfranchised to a certain extent, because we were now building a large corporate strategy and analysis staff, which would take over all of the strategic analysis functions, and finance would kind of look at the here and now and do the P&A and so forth. But the real long range planning was going to be done by CSA. So needless to say, finance didn't give up any of theirs. CSA assumed new functions, and you had a multiple long-range plans. But finance was told, no, you do the budget and the forward year review, and that's it. And all the long-range stuff is going to be. So the CSA started looking at, 10 and 15 years out. And we actually sat in a meeting where we were discussing a Ford Escort two generations out from the current car. And we were arguing about, and this is Phil Caldwell in the chairman's seat, and I was to his left, and we were discussing millimeters of rear legroom, and I was smoking a cigar and staring off into space, and at some point Phil Caldwell turns to me and said, are we boring you, Bob? And I said, well, Phil, to be honest, yes, because I ask myself where the value is here. where we're arguing about dimensions of a car that's like 10 years out, will have at least two generations in between. We don't know how the market's going to go. We don't know how fuel's going to go. We don't know anything about government regulations. We don't know anything about competitor activity. I don't know, Volkswagen may launch a much larger Golf, which, of course, they did, in which case whatever dimensions we establish today aren't going to be worth anything because we'll have to respond to competition. So I just don't see any value in this time we're spending here on minute, detailed planning of stuff that doesn't have to be decided until 8 years from now, which Caldwell put his fingers together like this and said, well, I thought that when we got rid of Lee Iacocca, I thought we had gotten rid of the last of the hip shooters, but I see that I'm mistaken.
Hey, we're going to have to take another quick commercial break here. But before we do, you very graciously gave us a number of books to give away to some of our viewers.
Oh, great. Okay.
And we had them write in saying, hey, I want a book. And, of course, a whole lot more wrote in than we've got books to give away. So we're going to ask you to pick out several names. How many names do we have to go, Chip? Five names. So, Bob, if you don't mind, would you... Chip, come on in, and let's have Bob pick out.
Okay, I don't actually have to make a judgment here. I
just pull out
dip into the hat.
One at a time. Go ahead.
One
at a time.
Eric Vasilov.
Okay.
All right. Congratulations, Eric. Paul Saltzman. Man of salt.
Right.
Jonathan Brown. That sounds like a fake name.
He's a real guy.
Yeah. And David Sproul.
Oh, good.
S-P-R-O-W-L.
Yeah, David Sproul, he's a good viewer of ours, right.
And
one more.
We got one more. I'm going to dig to the bottom here to avoid bias. Oops. John Faulkner.
Wow. Must be brother of William.
Yeah. An author in his own right.
That's right. Well, great. Good. Thanks for picking that out. And Ben, why don't we give a shout out to our friends at Hyundai?
I can do this. This is hard.
Listen here. Cool.
Yes. Nope.
The GT is nice.
Yeah. I can't figure out which.
An easy decision just got harder.
What's happening?
Sorry about that. The Elantra, now also available in coupe and GT.
Oh, boy.
From Hyundai.
Okay, this is the part of the show where we go to questions from the audience. We call it rapid fire. Ben, let that rip. Okay, the first question, Bob, comes from Martin Sinzig, the Chevy guy from Switzerland, he says, and wants to know what's...
He wrote the Chevrolet book. Good guy, him. Yeah.
He wants to know, what's going on with Via Motors? Will it ever fly?
Via Motors, I guess we have to say it's a company on which board I serve that takes full-size General Motors vans and pickups and ultimately sports utilities. Converts them to the Volt extended range electric vehicle system, and it's for commercial fleets. It's the one electric vehicle that provides an immediate payback, and there's substantial advanced demand. VIA received a pretty major setback when A123 went out of business because they lost their battery supplier and. The company now has to look for an alternate supplier, and swapping battery suppliers in midstream costs you about 18 to 24 months. So there's still the current plan is still to be on the market with an electric Chevy Express van for which there's a great deal of interest by a lot of large corporations before the end of the year.
He also wants to know real quick, which would you rather have, the new Stingray or the almighty Camaro ZL1?
That's a tough one, but I'll go for the Stingray.
Doug Goldberg wants to know, given all the various cars that you've been involved with in the development of, Which one are you the most proud of?
Well, I say that all the time. It's still the Chevy Volt.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's a technological masterpiece.
Very good. Eric Rumblestrip wants, a.k.a. Rumblestrip, wants to know, are there any auto ads, print, or video that you think have an edge to them that are not politically correct or overly focus grouped?
Well, I just recently saw an ad. I think it's a long one, but it runs, it's viral now. I think it started in the U.K. It's called Honda Hands. Have you seen that?
No.
I know it's computer-generated imagery, but it shows a pair of hands.
Yeah, we had it on our website.
Yeah, and they twiddle, and it's a motorcycle, and then twiddles again, it's a lawnmower, twiddles again, it's a car, twiddles again, it's a Honda Jet. The only bad thing in that video is there is a burnout by a Honda Accord with the rear wheel smoking.
Unless it's an S2000, that's about the only one that would do it, right?
That's right.
Hey, we got all kinds of phone calls coming in. I'm not sure we're going to get to them all, but Ben, let's bring one of them in.
Yes, this is for Bob Lutz. I have to agree with you about the finish on the Jeep. The quality, the V6 is superb. The 8-speed transmission is one of the best. And the car is just a phenomenal-looking car. I have one other question, Bob. And is there a new Bob Lutz somewhere in the GM company? Semper Fi.
Thank you. Are you one, too? Good. Well, I'm not sure that the company wants or needs another one just like me, but I am very comfortable that the company is riddled with people who are passionate about cars. And you don't need a single champion if you've got a senior management that smiles benevolently on people who are passionate about cars. And I think that environment now exists in all three American companies.
Greg Swan says, Bob, I'm a huge fan. My dad, Warren Swan, worked with you and Lee Iacocca and tells the story about a meeting that you were in with Dick Doak, who said it was a bad idea doing such and such in Europe, and you stood up and shouted, shut the F up.
Yeah.
Is that true?
It sounds like it might be true. Dick Doak required a heavy leadership hand.
We've got more calls coming in. Ben, let's bring one in.
Hi, this is Victor Cece's calling from Cleveland, Ohio. This is a message for Bob Lutz. Bob, I have a 2012 Volt. I absolutely love the car. I want to thank you very much for all the effort that you put into getting the Volt to the market. It is just a great car. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you. I love mine, too.
Dennis from Toronto says, wants to know, will GM ever build a mid-engine Corvette?
It's always in the plan. It has been in the plan for the last 30 years. So who knows?
Okay. We got another phone call here, Ben. Let's bring it in.
Hi, guys. I'm Nick Rogovis from New Haven, Connecticut. Great show as always. One of the reasons GM made bad cars was their high cost structure preventing them from being competitive with their counterparts who did not have high labor and legacy costs. I just finished reading Paul Ingrassia's Crash Course about the auto collapse. In it, there are several examples of General Motors trying to confront the high cost structure and the UAW. Management always seemed to back down when it came down to it. When he took over, Rick Wagoner's turnaround plan stretched for decades. The board, despite Jerry York, ended up backing Wagoner to the bitter end. Obama's auto task force leaders thought GM was one of the worst run companies they had ever seen. What was it about GM that didn't allow them to confront the looming disaster in front of them? Have things changed? Thanks a lot, guys.
Well, that's almost a subject for another whole evening.
Yeah.
But I will say the Obama task force saw basically two companies. They saw a company that perhaps was not as well run as you would want administratively and from a marketing standpoint. But I think they were extremely impressed with what was going on in product development and manufacturing. They came into it with this old image of dirty factories, greasy floors, surly workers, and so forth. And what they found were clean, well-lit, well-equipped, beautiful, spotless plants with impeccably trained associates and so forth. That kind of blew him away. That was counter to it. I think only one member of the team, I think it was Ratner, said it was the worst run company he'd ever seen. Frankly, I would challenge that assertion. The whole American automobile business was trapped in an environment of enormous legacy costs and enormous debt load and UAW liabilities for health care and retiree costs that simply could not be fixed, especially not when there was a sudden collapse of the market.
If I can just interject one quick thing. I read Ratner's book, and it was a little self-serving in some ways.
A little.
But the one thing that did strike me was his assertion that the financial controls and administration and just bookkeeping were horrible. And I was no defender of GM. I mean, for the most of my 30 years in the auto business, they produced crap cars. The one thing I did think was the financial controls would be good. I mean, after all the chairmen had come up through Finance Snap, they were lifers.
That was my big surprise. So the financial systems, the financial forecasting systems, the measuring systems, knowing where you are at any given point, were actually far better at Chrysler than at GM.
How is that possible for a company that's been run by Finance Snap guys since forever?
Well, I think it's part of what the British call too clever by half. They started relying more and more on these analytical forecasting techniques, which was called variance analysis. If we're here today and we do such and such, is that going to be better or worse than where we are today? And where we are today was always a sort of supposedly a good assumption, but it really wasn't, because as this whole analytical system expanded and grew, the good old-fashioned accounting system where they, guys were making entries and where you knew where you were in every category, that withered. And the accounting system became like totally unreliable. And the analytical system was perfected, and it could tell you whether this was going to be better or worse, but it was better or worse than what? You didn't know what the what was anymore. And we had frequent conversations about that, and actually the overhaul of the accounting system began before the government stepped in, but, it was a huge, huge, huge task because it was a genuine mess.
Yeah. I'll just add in this little aside. Remember, Ratner was the guy who the state of New York had to go after and find millions of dollars for a kickback scheme that he was involved in. I don't know why anybody still uses this guy on their TV programs as a commentator today. Just my little aside.
Let's hope you don't get sued, but it's only your opinion.
It's only my opinion.
You didn't make any allegations, so you're safe.
That's right. Goggles Pisano says, if you could become a chairman of any car company today, which one would you choose?
I wouldn't choose a good one because it wouldn't be a challenge. That's an unanswerable question, but I am chairman of an automobile company today, and it's called VL Automotive. So I've already got a job.
There you go. We've got more phone calls than we can get to. Let's try to squeeze one more in.
Hi, this is Dan from Georgia. I was calling to get your thoughts regarding the new Silverado pickups. They seem to be very conservative, and you had reported that the new F-150 will drop 700 pounds in weight beginning next year. And I just wonder if Chevy's going to be able to compete with a car that, at least on paper, is going to be 4 to 5 years ahead of it. Thank you.
Well, we'll see. I've talked about this with Mark Rice. Mark Rice is very confident. Obviously, GM isn't going to stop. Mass reduction is one of Dan Ackerson's top priorities. He's actually set arbitrary targets for mass reduction. And the weight of the pickup doesn't really matter. What matters is what does the pickup do? What's its payload? How much does it tow? What's the torque? What's the fuel economy? And mainly, what's the price? So what very few people know is that Ford has a mass deficit to General Motors today. So part of that, part of the savings from using aluminum are just going to be to catch up where the Silverado and the Sierra are today. But you say they're conservative. I somewhat disagree with that. I think the styling does not break any new ground, but, you know, pickup owners don't want the styling to break any new ground. They're going to be highly successful trucks.
Yeah, I'd say it is conservatively styled, but it's a terrific truck.
Yeah.
In fact, I got a Sierra, GMC Sierra, out in the parking lot right now. And, I mean, it's almost a luxury car. That's how well done it is.
Well, they've all gone that way. I'm driving a Silverado right now myself, and it drives beautifully. But I've also done some race car towing in one of the new Dodge Rams with the V6, and I'm just shocked at how comfortable that thing is. And it yanks along a 5,500-pound trailer like nothing.
This reminds me of one of my favorite, when Nissan did the Titan, the U.S. media were full of, well, this is the end of Detroit. You know, the Japanese have cleaned them out in passenger cars, and now they're doing pickup trucks. So this is the end of Detroit as we know it. And it was even worse when Toyota did the Tundra. And now this is the final nail in the coffin and so forth. What they don't understand, people don't understand, is that nobody will ever do, no foreign company will ever do a pickup truck as well as an American company. I mean, these three American companies are in a fierce competitive battle against each other. It's almost like a blood sport. They all know each other. They know each other socially. They like each other, but they're fierce competitors. And anytime there's a news leak that our new one is going to have 20 pounds more torque than yours, they immediately go to engineering and say, we need 50 pounds more torque. I mean, it is almost a battle to the death. And who benefits? The customer. And I mean, honest to God, if I were Nissan or Toyota right now, I would say, we can't win in this business. Let's get out and concentrate on the stuff that we do know how to do. American pickup trucks are fantastic.
And that's probably a good night or a good note to end us up. I mean, we could go on for another hour here. We've got enough questions and whatnot coming in. But Bob Lutz, thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you. Thank you for listening to me. Now that I'm sort of partly retired, I don't get the privilege of having a group of intelligent people forced to listen to me anymore.
Look, we'll have you back on. You don't even have to go out and write another book to get invited back either. Chubba, great having you here, too. It's
always a pleasure.
Yeah. And Peter?
Glad to be here, John, as always.
Cool. So thanks for having tuned in, everybody, and we'll be back here again next week.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.